There have always been tensions between intellectuals and cultural producers in Cuba and the state. The degree of tension and the openness of that tension and the tactics used by the government to control that tension have changed.
Hi, and welcome back to another episode of the Art Persist podcast, a series by Bosler Arts offering a glimpse into the life of artists and activists from all over the world, here to share their stories with you, the listener. I'm your host, Georgia Beeston, and in today's episode we have the amazing Coco Fusco. Coco is an interdisciplinary artist and writer. She's a professor of art at Cooper Union and a recipient of numerous amazing awards, including a Guggenheim Fellowship, an American Academy of Arts and Letters Award, amongst many others. She's also the author of many books, including Dangerous Moves, Performance and Politics in Cuba, English is Broken Here, Notes on Cultural Fusion in the Americas, The Bodies That Were Not Ours, and others. And it was fantastic to chat to Coco. We talk about her life growing up in New York and what that was like. We talk about her relationship with Cuba, and also we talk in depth about the situation in Cuba for many artists and activists at this point in time. So a huge thank you to Coco for joining us, and I hope you enjoy the episode. Well, hi Coco, and thank you so much for coming on the Art Persist podcast. Maybe you could start, we're going to talk a lot about your work and your collaboration with artists in Cuba, but could you start by telling us a little bit about your early life, where you grew up and what life was like?
Sure. Well, I was born and raised in New York. I am the first American born in a Cuban immigrant family. And I grew up in Manhattan and the Bronx mostly, and then moved to Brooklyn when I got out of, when I finished my studies. New York City in the 60s and 70s was, in some ways, a very exciting and electrified place, but it was also a period of a lot of conflict. And, New York almost went bankrupt in the 70s, and we had riots and blackouts and all sorts of things. But because of the exodus of a lot of industry during that time, there was a lot of empty industrial buildings that artists moved into, and depressed area of the city where rents were low, where creative types could live for practically nothing. And that really was the sort of economic underpinning of this flowering of avant-garde practice in so many different fields. So this, made the city a kind of creative hub.
And how did you get interested in art to start with?
Well, I was a big kind of, I think I was a bit of a bookworm when I was a kid, but I also liked to perform, and I did theater when I was in high school. And then, when I got to college, my mom was very, you can't do that kind of thing. It's going to lead you nowhere, and so on and so forth. So she was very threatening. And I also had a sort of dual side of me, because I was a bit of a theory head in my college days. But I was interested, and then I continued to be interested. I studied film semiotics as an undergraduate, and I had a professor there, Leandro Katz, who's an Argentine artist who was part of this South American exodus. And I went to work with him at his studio when I graduated, and through my work with him, met a lot of artists. And I was really, interested and excited in their conceptually driven interdisciplinary practice. So I guess that was my inroad in.
Yeah, and that's interesting because you are such an interdisciplinary artist. I mean, your work encompasses performance, film, photography, writing, a lot of different things. Can you tell us, maybe introduce for maybe those people who don't know you, what your practice is and how those different kind of forms come into play with one another?
Well, I'm not one of the, I didn't, I'm not like a traditional visual art student. I didn't go to art school. I would never have been able to get the support to do that, from my family. And I also don't, you know, I didn't exhibit very strong, like drawing skills or anything like that as a kid. And to get into art school here, if you can't draw, forget it. So my inroad was more in through moving image work, lens, what is now called lens-based practice and performance. And I was interested in artists who had interdisciplinary practices. I studied with people who had interdisciplinary practices. I liked the idea of being able to begin with an idea and then figure out the best way to realize it. And and that's has turned out to be the most comfortable way for me to be, you know, to work. I do a lot of writing, which some people get all sort of bent out of shape about, of like, well, are you a writer? Are you an artist? Are you a writer? Are you an artist? And I'm like, you know, there are quite a few examples of very respected visual artists who also write, like Mary Kelly or Alan Sekula, or even Edward Ruscha has written, Dan Graham, Greg Bordowitz, Andrea Fraser, you know. But it's somehow or other, this becomes like, well, why do you do that? Or how is that possible? Or are you really an artist? And, you know, I my response is always, but there are all these other artists who do it. Why are you making it an issue for me? I think that added to that is a reality that, you know, I'm in my 60s now. When I began in the 1980s, there was no serious, consistent appreciation or even institutional support for artwork and artists from the global, what's now known as the global South, or ethnic minorities in the United States or Europe. It just was, you know, was a battle, and there wasn't a kind of critical literature either that one could turn to. And so I don't think I'm the only person who saw this, but that, you know, many of my peers, we did feel a necessity to kind of create a critical discourse around what we were doing because it didn't exist.
Yeah, and it's weird to hear that people would have a problem with you as an established artist writing.
It's weird, okay? You know, I think for young people now, they think that the world was the way it was, you know, that this is the way the world was 40 years ago. You know, in the 80s, I had a meeting at Channel 4 about a video that I, documentary that I co-produced about postmodernism in Cuba, and the commissioning editors said, how could they have a postmodernism if they never had modernity? Okay. You know, I was present at many interactions, in the early interactions between the Black British workshops and Black artists in the 80s and institutions. And the racism was pervasive, and the dismissiveness of, you know, white artists, curators, and the museums was universal. We were, you know, fighting against erasure in a big way. And the backlash against us for pointing it out and complaining about it was real. So when you're considered an interloper, when you're considered an outsider, and when people don't want to share the goodies they have, they'll come up with all kinds of arguments. You know, this is not unusual.
And I want to talk to you a lot about your relationship with Cuba. Obviously, I think I heard that you first went to Cuba when you were a month old, perhaps.
Yeah.
Right. And you have worked there, you've collaborated a lot. Can you just tell us a little bit about your relationship to Cuba, but also the kind of cultural and artist scene there?
So my mother was not one of the sort of aristocratic elite Cubans who left after the revolution because their properties were seized.
Yeah.
My mother was a Black Cuban from a very humble background who worked her way through university and studied medicine and got permission to enter the United States in the mid 50s to work as a doctor at a time when the US was looking for professionals in the post-war period to fill spots, right? But she came in the mid 50s and then she was deported in 1959. I'm still trying to figure out the details of the deportation, but the stories that she would tell me every year, because she would tell me the story of my birth when I was growing up, was that, you know, these immigration, that she was deported, that she got pregnant, that she convinced my father to marry her and then went into hiding. But immigration officials found her and told her that she would have to leave the country with me after I was born. So it took 30 days after my birth to get a passport for me to prove that I was American born. And then we went to Cuba in 1960, which is the year that I was born. So, you know, like within a year after the Cuban Revolution began, I have a picture of me landing within my mother's arms in Havana, getting off the plane. So I know it's not, you know, it's not an invention. It's true. And also I met cousins of mine who saw me there when I arrived with her in 1960. So we were able to, at that point, the agrarian reform law had not yet been implemented, but because this is in the early days, but the people who were trying to escape at that point were people who had been allied with the former government, with the government of Fulgencio Batista. And so they were trying to get out as quickly as possible. I mean, many of them were summarily executed in the first months of the revolution, accused of having been part of a police force that had repressed the leftists, right? So she, you know, she would leave me with my grandmother and get online at the U.S. Embassy, which was still open. We had not severed relations yet. And then finally, after a few months, she was able to get out. After that, you know, she got her papers, and then she was able to sponsor members of her family to come. So starting in 1963, we started receiving my grandmother, her sisters, her brother. My grandmother was from a family of 10 siblings. And so many of them were, between my mother and my grandmother, that trying to emigrate, and the cousins. And so every year or a year or two, more family would arrive. And so, you know, I went to school like a regular American kid, and then I would come home and be like teaching my cousins English or translating for adults, or, you know, this or that. And then, you know, some of my relatives had proclivities and habits that were unusual for Americans. I remember, you know, a great aunt who wanted to bring ducks and chickens into the yard, which my grandmother did do, but, you know, it was like not the normal thing to do in New York City. Just the things like that. And then there was the just sort of the constant flow of people through, you know, some relatives and some just family friends. And so I was exposed to all of, you know, the story of this and their arrival, and that, you know, through those experiences. And also my godfather had 8 daughters, and, I had no sisters, and my father died when I was just turning 11. And so my mother began to send me to spend time with my godfather's family, you know, during summers and holidays and stuff. And they were in Miami in the 70s when the Cuban community really took shape in Miami. Yeah. And so I got, you know, another level of exposure to that whole experience through them. You know, I was able to kind of keep things very compartmentalized, like what happened at home, or that was one part of my life that didn't have anything to do with the American high school, you know, because there wasn't anybody else in my educational environment who was going through the same thing that I was dealing with. So, you know, that's how it was. And then when I got out of school, a couple of years after I graduated from college, I met one of my mother's very close friends, another Cuban physician, had a very strong interest in Cuban art and was donating a lot of art materials and magazines and books to the libraries there, and so on and so forth. And he sponsored these Cuban artists who were coming to the United States to do a residency and exhibition and stuff. And he had a brunch one day at his house you know, told me to come and with my mom. And I met these artists and a curator and art historian who were there, and they invited me to go to Havana. And this was for me an opportunity to meet peers as opposed to going to see relatives. And I was very, interested in that. And so I decided to do it. And that began a whole, you know, adventure that hasn't ended since.
Just before we continue this episode, we want to tell you about a podcast we love listening to. It's called Media Storm, hosted by journalists Matilda Mallison and Helena Wadia. Media Storm is a weekly news and current affairs podcast, but one which focuses on the most underreported and misreported news stories. The hosts tackle the headlines with the most important people in the story, the voices missing from the mainstream news. You'll hear the lived experience of refugees, gender minorities, climate activists, and more. The show forces us to look beyond the Western worldview and gets to the facts behind all the fear-mongering, which is so important, especially in the run-up to the general election. So search Media Storm wherever you get your podcasts. We highly recommend you check it out. And obviously the situation in the arts and the culture in Cuba at the moment has radically changed. Since 2021, there were protests in July 2021 where many artists were arrested. Some, we're going to talk a bit about the ones, some artists who remain imprisoned, and many, many other artists have left. You've written before, previously, that, and I quote, social practice art that aims to create social or political change via collective endeavor has become something of an institutional fad in recent years. But in Cuba, it's the symbolic equivalent of a Molotov cocktail. I was wondering if you could expand a little bit on that, and maybe we can talk about some of the challenges that artists in Cuba are facing today.
Well, there have always been tensions between intellectuals and cultural producers in Cuba and the state. The degree of tension and the openness of that tension and the tactics used by the government to control that tension have changed over in the very early stage, because it's not 2021 is when there's a mass protest, but that's not when problems with artists began at all, right? You know, in the very early days of the revolution, there were a lot of young writers and artists who were very excited about it. You know, they thought, this is it now, you know, we will change the world, and we'll start a film institute, and we'll create all these organizations, and we'll make this. And within 2 or 3 years, censorship and control begins. And, you know, that over the period, over a period of about 10 years, leads to, on the one hand, you know, some people changing their tune and becoming much more hardcore and, you know, going by the books of the Marxist Leninist line of the state. And then there are also a lot of people who become disaffected over time and leave. There were artists like the musician Pablo Milanés, for example, was just one of thousands of people who were put into forced labor camps. There's the famous case of the poet Heberto Padilla, who was arrested and, you know, basically psychologically tortured for like a month and then forced to give a public confession in Cuba's version of a Stalinist show trial in 1971. There's a period called the Gray 5 Years, you know, El Quinquenio Gris in the 70s, when lots of very famous writers and artists, people like Virgilio Piñera, Pablo Armando Fernández, José Lezama Lima, were basically like, they were cut off from public life, not able to publish, not able to present their work publicly in any venue, you know, erased as counter-revolutionaries. So, you know, this is, and then, you know, then you get in the, by the end of the 70s, the establishment of the Ministry of Culture, the creation of the University of the Arts. I mean, there had been a national art school, but then you get this University of the Arts. And at that point, you know, we're talking about the revolution is now almost 30 years old. You have a generation of young people who didn't grow up before the revolutionary government was imposed. And so I think that there was a belief at that point that these were the, you know, they called the Che's children, that they were going to be the real revolutionary subjects, and that the others who were older had run into trouble because they were bourgeois, right? They had been, they came from the upper classes, they were educated before, and they weren't going to adapt to the strictures of the kind of new man that would that supposedly the revolution wanted to produce. So you get the, you know, this emergence of this generation in the 80s, and this did there was a moment of that was considered to be a kind of visual arts renaissance, and a lot of these young artists were questioning of the rules and tried in their own ways to kind of shuffle things around and make change and demand more openness and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
But I don't think that their confrontations were as open. And the tactics used to repress were very individualized. It would be like, this person is an enemy of the state, this person. And so that would create or intensify a culture of fear of like, well, if you associate with Jose, you're going to get in a lot of trouble. If you, you know, if you hang out with this person or so, you know, and that did happen. There was a wave of censorship in between 1989 and 91 that led to the exodus of a large portion of that 80s generation.
Yeah.
They went to Mexico. They went to Spain. They came to the United States. Then you get the special period in the 90s, which was a big kind of, you know, economic downturn after the disappearance of the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
And the government, in response to that, begins to, legalize possession of dollars. And artists were among the first group of so-called freelancers who were able to negotiate directly with foreigners to be able to have hard currency. And so that creates a situation in which, you know, artists see a kind of compromise might be beneficial, because if you don't complain too much openly and you don't confront the state too much, you can actually make a living there and be better off than many other people. And, you know, that went on for a while. But what starts to happen in around 2008 with the legalization of cell phone possession is that you get a lot of young people who are young creatives who are starting to they have phones, have more internet access, and are starting to use the internet as a space, as a kind of counter-hegemonic public sphere.
Yeah.
And that grows, you know, begins with like bloggers and independent musicians who are putting their music out there. Then in 2013, there's changes in law so that you didn't need to have an exit visa from the Cuban government to be able to travel. So people who didn't, you know, weren't members of the Artists and Writers Union, had not gone through the whole kind of institutional legitimation process, but who considered themselves artists, could leave the country and present their work without, you know, needing any support from outside. And that was a big shift. That was when the writer and blogger Yoani Sanchez was able to leave and come to the United States for the first time. So that made it possible for artists to like go abroad, make some money, buy equipment, buy materials, bring them home, make a studio in your house. And that begins to grow. And then you get the Obama administration trying to open things up with Cuba and foundations coming in and trying to find ways to support independent business, independent culture, so on and so forth. And that created a lot of expectations among young artists about what they would be able to do, right?
Yes.
What they would be able to do, the freedom that they would have. And that all came tumbling down with the, well, first of all, the arrival of Díaz-Canel as the president in 2018, the election of Trump and the rescinding of a lot of that, and the implementation of a set of laws in beginning in 2018 designed to restrict the expression in public spaces, whether they're virtual or actual, right? So there's Decree 349 that applies to visual artists, 370 that applies to independent journalists. And because young people were using social media, the internet, websites, and so on to connect with the rest of the world, to publish, to circulate their music, to stream their own independent films, to do all sorts of things. And the government was like, right? And because the attack from the state was not on individuals, but on the sector as a group, you know, as an entity, I think that really politicized a lot of people. Not only were they disappointed because their expectations were not met, but they were also being attacked as a as an entire sector. And yeah. I think that that explains why the response to this was collective. Mm. So what you start to see in 2018 are, you know, attempts by groups like the San Isidro movement and then later 27N and, you know, groups of independent filmmakers also getting together are these efforts to try to confront the state, right? Mm. And say, you know, stop, don't do this. We, we want a public discussion of the legitimacy of these things, or we, and the most outspoken and the most sort of far, far out exponents of these beliefs were the ones that were attacked the hardest by the government. Mm. So, you know, most of the people in the San Isidro movement were self-taught. 27N, yeah. These were art school graduates. And so San Isidro movement is more Black. 27N is more white. Mm. It is not entirely that way, but it is largely that way.
Yeah.
And, you know, because the self-taught artists had the double problem of being more outspoken, but also being more working class and yes. not having the stamps of legitimacy of like degrees and so on, or membership in unions and so on, the state was much more punitive with them. Yeah. And yeah. so the people who are, you know, now in prison, like Luis Manuel Otero, Michael mm-hmm. Absorbo, yeah. They are people who hail from that sector. So for 27N, the art school graduates tend to be the ones who were forced into exile. Mm. One exception of this is Hamlet Labastida, who is an art school graduate, who had been out of the country on a residency in Berlin in 2020, mm. comes back to Cuba basically to like change his clothes and fix some papers, and is arrested in 2021, right when before the July 2021 protest, mm. and was held for 3 months. And, you know, there was an international campaign to have him released. But I think that part of the reason why we were successful mm. in that effort was first because he had not yet been tried when we got okay. him out, you know, mm. so he hadn't been sentenced, right? He had only been accused. Mm. They couldn't really pin anything on him. And, you know, there was a public outcry.
Yeah. Coco, you've given us such a fantastic kind of overview of everything that's happened in Cuba over the last few decades. And you've also mentioned, obviously, the Cuban art activists who have more recently been oppressed by the state. And actually, you mentioned the Cuban poet Alberto Padilla and his kind of forced confession. And you created an amazing project called Padilla Shadow, where artists and activists in Cuba read aloud this public confession that you spoke about. Could you tell us a bit about that work, and also going on everything you've just said, the significance of having artists read it out from 1971.
Yeah, so I should back up and say, before I made that piece, I made a video called The Confession that was about Padilla's confession, about that case and the way that that case hangs over all Cuban artists ever since. And I did it in 2015 for the Venice Biennale, and I was motivated because for the first time, like a year before or so, a fragment of the filmed version of that confession became public. It was appeared in a documentary that people had been talking for, you know, at that point for more than 40 years about, they knew it had been filmed. They saw mm-hmm. the cameras, you know, people knew it had been filmed because the camera crew was right there in the room, and that film was never had never reached the public. And so it was sort of like, that film, where is it? You know, is it hiding somewhere in the Film Institute? Is the footage in the Council of State? Did the government? Because when Padilla did the confession in 71, the government thought that the confession would serve as an indicator that the government was right and Padilla was wrong. Yes. And that the international response would be in favor of the government. So a printed transcript of his confession was circulated to all the embassies in Havana at the time, you know, sent to the press and so on and so forth. And it produced the opposite effect. You know, people like Susan Sontag and, you know, Di Solo and all these intellectuals who had in the 60s gone to Cuba and supported the revolution were horrified. Vargas Llosa, who had been a juror for the Casa de las Americas Literary Prize, was like, not going to go back to Cuba anymore. So, you know, they many of these writers published letters in the New York Review of Books and, you know, protested publicly for Padilla's treatment. And I think that that may have caused the government to kind of go, okay, let's not put the film out there, you know, like enough, right? So, but then a fragment appears in this documentary and you're like, oh, it exists and somebody knows where it is and somebody... So I built a whole video around it with archival material from the time telling the story of what happened, but also telling it as a, you know, a younger person in, you know, in Havana, going back to all the spots, the Hotel Riviera where he had written his poetry, the place where he had lived with his wife, the, you know, the exterior of Villa Marista, the headquarters of state security. Like I was going back to the, like the ghosts, right? Of these things and their presence in the landscape. And then it was coming, what was coming up was the 50th anniversary in 2021 of his confession. Now that confession, that transcript that I said was circulated to embassies was also published in a magazine. I think it was in the Casa de las Americas magazine at the time. So intellectuals of the time had access to the transcript, and many members of the Cuban Union of Artists and Writers were present, were in the room when he gave the confession. But after that time, no more official public discussion of him in Cuba. So it occurred to me, this was during the pandemic, and this is in 2021 in the spring, after, you know, many artists had already gotten into trouble, people were under arrest and or, you know, under house arrest or being harassed all the time, being pulled in for interrogations. And I just thought, okay, so let's do this kind of collective reading. This is when we were all stuck at home, right? And then on the day of the anniversary, five different museums in different in Europe and in the United States brought, you know, streamed it, right? So that was, you know, that was how that piece came about. And in it are many people who, there are Cubans from Cuba, Cubans in exile, you know, some of whom had been, you know, interrogated, harassed, expelled, you know, that they had had experiences similar to that of Padilla.
Absolutely. And I want to talk now, kind of go back to Luis Manuel Otero Alcantara. I hope I just said his whole name correctly. Mm-hmm. You're a vocal advocate for his release and for his freedom. Could you tell us maybe about why he was imprisoned by the state and also what perhaps the international community can be doing more to support his release?
Okay, so I am not the only person supporting Luis Manuel. I am probably the person who does it in English more than anybody else. And part of the reason why I do it is because I can do it in English. Because, you know, I follow Cuban media, independent media, fairly closely to stay abreast of what's going on and what's being said. And, you know, there's a constant attention to the plight of, now it's like 1,067 political prisoners in Cuba, the majority of whom were arrested during the July 2021 protests.
Yeah.
And, you know, that why is there a concern? Because there are so many, because they're innocent, because they're unjustly imprisoned, because Cuba has the highest per capita number of political prisoners in the Western Hemisphere, and nobody else gives a shit. You know, and part of the reason why nobody else in the world gives a shit is because a lot of people in the world are still living in the tropical socialism fantasy world of thinking that the revolution is this beneficent, you know, entity that has transformed the lives of Cuban people and empowered them and educated them and given healthcare. And they don't bother to actually look at what is going on in the country, see that, you know, the entire public sector has imploded, and that embargo or not embargo, it's a police state. In the last two years, a half a million Cubans have tried to leave the country and actually succeeded in leaving the country and are going anywhere in the world, including going to Russia and fighting in the Russian army to escape from there. Okay. So, you know, that is why, you know, for people who are Cuban and of Cuban descent who are following, it is a huge issue that has affected not just those in prison, but their families, their friends. And it has completely, you know, created an atmosphere of impossibility for creatives and civil rights activists in the country. Luis happens to be somebody who I know personally, who's a friend with whom I have collaborated on projects, and he's a performance artist, and he's been unjustly imprisoned now almost 3 years, right? So, you know, it's just, it just, you guys hear me in the English speaking world because I do it in English.
Of course, of course. Yeah. And in November 2023, you translated one of his statements, which he recorded and shared from inside prison. And he talks, and maybe I'll quote him here. He says, "There rises within me a rebellious spirit that does not allow me to resign myself. I just hope to get through the depression and frustration that comes with the end of the year, surviving in these conditions. I will see what I can come up with to try and alter the reality around me in 2024. I was wondering, as someone who's close, as someone who's part of the group of people who are advocating for his release, do you see his reality changing in 2024?
No, unfortunately, and it's heartbreaking. You know, there have been attempts to negotiate with the Cuban government over all of the political prisoners to try to argue for their release. This has been going on between, most openly between the United States and Cuba, but they've gone absolutely nowhere. The Cuban government doesn't want to release them. They want, you know, the Cuban government is just not. First of all, the Cuban government says that they don't have political prisoners, that there's no such thing as political crimes, that all these people are rabble rousers and, you know, vandals and so on and so forth. So they don't recognize the political dimension of this. So there's a problem there of, you know, legal understanding and vocabulary. That's number one. Number two, these people, just like all political prisoners in Cuba, have always been our pawns in an international game. And the and Cuba, you know, when Cuba had the exiles who went in during the Bay of Pigs invasion to try to overthrow the government and failed, and they imprisoned, I don't know, you know, more than 1,000 of them who were there. Eventually, those prisoners were sold. You know, in exchange for tractors and baby food and whatever else it was in 1962. And whenever the government has released political prisoners, it's always an exchange, right?
Yes.
And what what the government wants right now is to be removed from the list of countries that support terrorism. Because being on that list means that they don't have access to a lot of possibility of banking possibilities that would enable them to get more loans and so on and so forth. So if the United States doesn't take them off that list, they're not going to release the political prisoners. The problem there is that if the Biden administration takes them off the list now, that could affect Biden's electability in at the end of this year. There have been recent moves by Republican members of Congress, Cuban-American Republican members of Congress, to tighten the certain rules even more to basically have even more of a kind of economic stranglehold on Cuba. So this is not a moment in which the Cuban government is going to give up.
No, it makes total sense. And thank you for that. And thank you so much for this episode. I mean, I've taken so much of your time, but I feel like it's a really important episode to listen to in terms of actually understanding what is happening in Cuba. So thank you so much, Coco. I guess my last question for you is, I mean, we haven't really talked about your work that much, but what are you working on at the moment? What have you got coming up in your professional capacity?
Well, you know, I had my first retrospective was opened at KW Institute of Contemporary Art in Berlin last September. A new version of that exhibition is going to be at MACBA in Barcelona next year. So I'm working with the curators now on that. I am also preparing a public art project for here in New York that will launch in October in the weeks right before the election. That's an attempt to kind of intervene in the public discussion of the migrants who that have arrived here. You know, like over 170,000 migrants have arrived in New York in the last couple of years, which is a significant number of people. It's not the largest number of migrants that have ever arrived in New York, but it's a significant number. And because many of them arrived because they've been bused by the government, by the governor of Texas or Florida, to the country, they don't arrive because they have contacts here or family here, which means that they're more vulnerable and more dependent on support from the public sector, right, from the government. But I'm working on video animations that are for these Link NYC signs, which are up all around the city to kind of send a message out about how, you know, everybody who lives in New York is a New Yorker, even the people who just got here, they're also New Yorkers. That this historically has been a city of immigrants. And we lost 500,000 people during COVID who left New York City. So 170,000 arriving shouldn't be such a terrible thing.
That sounds like a very important and also a wonderful message. So I look forward to sadly not seeing it myself in person because I am in London, but seeing it online. And thank you, Coco, just again, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you today, and I look forward to seeing everything that you're doing in the future. We'd like to thank Coco Fusco for joining us for this week's episode. As always, if you'd like to learn more about her amazing work, please find links in the episode description. And thank you for joining us for another episode of the Artpsist podcast. As always, if you are enjoying the podcast, we ask that you follow us wherever you listen, rate the show, and share with friends and family. And if you want to go above and beyond supporting this podcast, you can also join us on Patreon, which will go towards making even more episodes, interviewing more artists, and generally expanding the podcast. All information is on the link in the episode description. And thank you so much for listening, and we'll be back next week with the season 6 finale.